On March 1st, 2013, the Wharton Esherick Museum in Paoli, Pennsylvania, opened an exhibition titled Wharton and Sherwood, A Friendship in Wood and Words, highlighting the friendship between Chester County sculptor Wharton Esherick and noted American author Sherwood Anderson. The two originally met in 1919 in Fairhope, Alabama, where a lasting friendship was born. Sherwood Anderson is best known for his collection of short stories, Winesburg, Ohio. That from a report in the Daily Local, March 6, 2013. Sherwood Anderson wasn't the only writer friend Wharton Esherick had. Theodore Dreiser, author of Sister Carrie, was another. And Laura Hemer of the Wharton Esherick Museum tells us it was Dreiser who introduced Esherick to the English writer Ford Madox Ford, and that Ford and his partner Janice Biala stayed with Esherick at his home in the mid-1930s, during which time Ford actually went to work on an early novel sitting at a desk, the flat top or sawhorse desk, created by Esherick in 1929. And in that novel, The Great Trade Route, Ford describes Esherick's studio in these words. A dim studio in which blocks of rare woods, carver's tools, medieval-looking carving gadgets, looms, printing presses, rise up like ghosts in the twilight, while the slow fire dies in the brands. Such a studio, built by the craftsman's own hands out of chunks of rock and great balks of timber, sinking back into the quiet woods on a quiet crag, with, below its long windows, quiet fields parceled out by the string courses of hedges and running to a quietly rising horizon. Such a quiet spot is the best place to think in. And let Esherick be moving noiselessly about in the shadows, with a plane and a piece of boxwood, or swinging backwards the lever of his press, printing off his engravings, or pouring 100 times heavy oil and emery powder on one of the tables he has designed, and rubbing it off with claws to get the polish exactly true, and bending down again and again to see the sheen of the light along the polished wood. Those are the conditions you need for thought, because they present to your mind neither success nor failure, but conditions coeval with the standing rocks and the life of man. There have always been craftsmen, and the craftsmen have always been the best men of their time, because a handicraft goes at a pace commensurate with the thoughts in a man's head. Words of writer Ford Madox Ford in The Great Trade Route. Ford Madox Ford makes a point of capturing a sense of Esherick's studio in its silence. And we're about to learn that when Ford writes about this quiet spot as the best place to think in, we might substitute the word listen for think. A quiet spot is the best place to listen in. And we'll learn Esherick developed a relationship with, a respect for the wood he worked with. Might we even say a friendship with these various woods, in such a way that he said he took direction from his materials, listening closely and deeply. We're about to meet a filmmaker who was struck dramatically by her first visit to Wharton Esherick's studio, and soon she began listening carefully to his story as told by his family and by his friends and by his work. And she has created a documentary film titled I Am Known as an Artist, Wharton Esherick, which recently had its premiere at the Barnes Foundation in Philadelphia. Carolyn Cole is a native of the Bloomsburg area. She is an award-winning writer and director with a portfolio in film and advertising, who began her career in television and music video production. As a copywriter in Austin, she spearheaded an emerging media unit, developing concepts for branded content, and directed corporate videos. Returning to film and television, Colt produced multiple behind-the-scenes and first-look projects for major studios. In addition to her work in film and advertising, Cole has taught communications and film studies at Emerson College, Chapman University, and Cal State University, Fullerton, where she is a tenured professor. Carolyn Cole came east for the premiere and paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about the project and the way she first discovered Wharton Escherich.
Every community in Pennsylvania, I've noticed, has its little attraction. And you can't be in the Philadelphia area without bumping into history somewhere. Within 5 feet, there's always something. And outside Philadelphia, of course, there's even more history. When I was home for a holiday break in 2013, my sister suggested we see a woodworker shop. And of course, we thought, why not? Let's do it. On a lark, we kind of decided to go over. We made a reservation. And that shop is called the Wharton Escherich Museum. Wharton Escherich was an individual who was an artist first, and he found his passion in woodworking. He was born just before the turn of the century, grew up in the Philadelphia area. His family came from some money. He had a banker, grandfather, and over time, though, he was not interested in conventional society. He was educated at what became the Philadelphia Academy of Art, but actually didn't finish there because he didn't want to paint the way other people were painting. So he moved into the country, into the Chester County area, and ultimately bought a home with his wife, had some children, and then really lost his passion for painting and became interested in woodworking. His initial pieces of furniture were kind of crude designs. He also did woodcuts and he did sculptures. But he found that he really loved to design and build individual pieces of furniture, and he established a lifestyle that really has given permission to other woodworkers to do the same. Prior to his time, only painters really worked in the studio making one painting at a time. And what Wharton Escherich really did was establish a kind of framework for other woodworkers to produce individual pieces, to have a kind of life that would allow that, and to really pursue his passion at that depth, wherein he didn't work in a factory setting, he didn't make thousands of pieces. And while you, I'm sure, know Nakashima, and even later in mid-century, the Eameses and so on, their furniture was mass-produced and therefore more well-known. In some ways, Wharton Escherich has kind of lost to history for that reason.
What happened when you opened the door and saw this work for the first time then?
Let me set the scene for you. It was late winter, so it was gorgeous. The sun was low, and in that kind of rich sunlight, that just everything looks beautiful, and that place is beautiful. It almost looks like Geppetto's cottage, right? In the middle of the woods, he was this man who had he really lived a very singular life. But when we walked in, we were taken through with a docent, and it's a couple of stories, and it's so unique to his personality. But when you open the door, awe comes over your face, and everyone just says, wow. And it's so silent inside the studio itself. It really contains a kind of solemnity without being serious, in that there's much comedy to the work that he produced. There's some very sweet pieces, some monkeys hanging off the walls and beautiful woodcuts that are very whimsical. But truly the work, the furniture, the goldenness of the wood, the depth of the wood, the sound that the wood brings, plus the enclosure, the studio itself was built with stone from local quarries, hauled in the early 20s when he decided to build the studio. So the richness of that alone, then the visual overload is fantastic. And everyone kind of becomes very quiet when they first walk in. And then the docent begins to share bits and pieces about history and how he found his way here, how he built the place. Individual pieces are described. And then every piece has some sort of magical quality to it. For instance, the table that he worked at has a drop-down leaf where he would have his work surface. But then when you go to pull out what looks like a drawer, it's actually a light that comes on and lights the surface where he can work. So there's little bits of magic like that everywhere. He created a really fun pulley system to create a trap door to his upstairs bedroom, which at one point was just a loft. And you just find that beauty and whimsy in every aspect of what he did.
Even the outhouse, we learned, was crafted not as just, we'll throw up a structure for this purpose.
Correct, yes. He really brought design to everything. And I think that's something that gets lost in contemporary culture. And I think that's something that individuals who are selling work on Etsy and craftspeople are really trying to reclaim. a kind of departure from mass industry and consumerism at that level. And I think that was also what he railed against and rejected. At the time, it was the place to go, I'm sure you would know, is New Hope. That was the art and culture sort of center outside the Philadelphia area. It was also expensive. And he was not a rich man at that point. He lived independently. He and his wife were having multiple children at that time, and he was trying to support them as a painter, but again, didn't feel like that was his passion and didn't feel like he could paint like Wharton Eschrick. He felt like he had to paint like Chase, the man he studied under, or one of the other famous artists of the time. And of course, Philadelphia has a rich history of paintings with the Wyeths and so on. I think that's where he really made his departure when he found wood.
And what was the call of the wood? Was it that it was organic as opposed to working with marble or stone in that way?
Yeah, I think it freed him to design in a way that he wasn't able to in painting. And he tried stone, but I think, again, the wood was a soft enough palette for him to design on. And he also spoke about wanting to develop pieces because the wood was speaking to him. He would say, the wood told me, as he would finish a piece and someone would say, how did you develop that curve? How did you think of that shape? And he would say, the wood told me. His son-in-law interviewed a number of people to develop a biography about Wharton Eschrick. And many of the people who spoke about Eschrick explained that he would often talk about how there was no thought in a straight line, that he really wanted to follow the organic quality of nature in the wood. And so I think that's really what spoke to him and what called him.
And yet we learn from your piece that though there may have been initial thoughts of a narrative, one of your commentators uses that word, that ultimately it was the wood itself that was going to speak and not the surface decor.
Correct. He did have what some people call three phases of work. His early work is very experimental. I know my early films were very experimental, kind of testing the medium, playing with narrative. What would that feel like? How would I do this if I wanted to tell this story? And I think he liked telling stories with his individual pieces, collection of pieces. He would also do whole roomscapes, and each piece would tell a different story. So in his early phase, he did do carving across the flat of the various pieces. There are several pieces that survive that time that are quite narrative in nature because they do tell some sort of a scripted story across the facade of it. In his second phase, he made pieces that were more angular, more Germanic in nature. They had some carving as well. And he kind of exited that phase very quickly because, again, because of the angles, he didn't feel like he was able to tell his own personal story, put his own signature to pieces. He then developed what he called his organic style. And that organic style is really what he's most well known for. You can find at the auction level at this point or has seen sales in that regard. And it's his organic work that really influenced other makers. He worked only with a few individuals, but many people came to be with him, came to his shop, came to watch his work. And he influenced a lot of teachers who then went to their wood programs, taught their students, and so on, which is really how I got the acorn as the icon for the film.
Develop that, because it's wonderful. And the quote from Emerson.
In considering Eschrick as someone who influenced a number of people, I had come across a quote by Ralph Waldo Emerson, who I'm sure people know as an American author. And he had said something to the effect of, 1,000 forests come from one acorn. And I really thought that really impacted me. As an educator, I think that too. I've influenced a number of students. But Wharton's style, his ability to live in his own home and make his own work one piece at a time for patrons, specific for their home, that was a really unique thing. And that work influenced other people, which influenced others. And nature has a beautiful way of recreating itself in such a way. It drops the acorns to the earth, they become covered, they grow new trees. And so from this one acorn of Wharton Eschrick, we developed forests full of other creators, including someone like myself who's been influenced by him. As a filmmaker, I was influenced by his work. I was stunned that no one had made a documentary about him, and I felt it was important to share his story. So I am a tree in his forest.
And it also indicates what we learn from your piece about his pioneering of an area which you've suggested already, that there weren't galleries that were showcasing this kind of work, and he was who he was and was a leader in it, mm-hmm. a visionary mm-hmm. in that way.
I think it can't be understated the influence of that community at the time. Rose Valley was nearby. and Rose Valley is known for its furniture makers. They were doing more arts and craft, individual pieces. There were factories where furniture was being made. Also in the Rose Valley area, however, was the Hedgerow Theater. And the Hedgerow Theater deserves its own documentary. It's a fascinating history of repertory theater, the longest running one. I do believe it's the longest running one in the United States. And it was born of people who came down from New York who were also rejecting the mass industry, the rise of the different culture in the big city New York area. And they founded this little community theater in what was an old factory. Again, a stone building built from the quarries of nearby. And they were creating art, bringing artists in, bringing writers in, and attracted people like Wharton Eshrick to come build their sets, to come build furniture for the actual staging of the plays. And so that community of artists also bolstered his interest in his individual thinking. He brought a lot of new thought into that community. It's also an era of new thought movement when we had philosophers and other individuals who were thinking about ways to step away from what was becoming a consumeristic culture in that early part of the 20s and 30s.
You know, I would have a sentimental feeling for the old tape recorder reel-to-reel, but that's a wonderful image, and the sense of telling the story that way. He didn't want an art historian to tell his story.
Sure, yeah. To share that part of the story, Bob Bascom is his son-in-law, married to Wharton Eshrick's daughter, Ruth. And Bob wanted to write a biography about Wharton Eshrick. While he was still alive, he approached him, and Wharton Eshrick said, no, I really don't want a biography about myself. I think he was very torn. He was someone who loved what he did and appreciated when people liked his work, but didn't really want the spotlight. In some ways, he didn't like being the center of attention. And I think in some ways, he would probably very much dislike the fact that I made a movie about him, right? So I find that kind of funny. We were talking about that at the opening. So Bob Bascom decided that he would write the biography, and he started to interview Wharton Eshrick. So what survived those was a number of reel-to-reels, several hours of interviews with him, but additionally, individuals that surrounded Wharton Eshrick, people who knew him, other artists. And in meeting those people or reading information about them, I realized there's three or four other documentaries in this project, people who were influencing art at the time that, again, are lost to history. And I fear maybe lost for good. So it was interesting for me to discover these other characters, a woman who came out of the New York area, whose name is Marjorie Content, who was a part of the Stieglitz Circle and had developed her own photography and was one of the first people to commission Wharton Eshrick. So it's a fascinating circle, concentric circles of these interesting artists in a time that I'm afraid we're losing. Bob Bascom decided to do this biography about Wharton Eshrick and interviewed all these people surrounding him. So the reel-to-reels, and I wanted to play a role in the film. And of course, the tactile nature of that, the old deck that he had, Bob Bascom himself, now in his 90s, was such an interesting gentleman to interview and discuss Wharton's history, his own history. He was an architect. He studied under Louis Kahn, another famous individual from Philadelphia.
And what I loved so much was just the quiet way you had Bob interacting with the recording. It was as if he was still there with his brother-in-law and they were talking across the table. And that quiet smile that came across as he was hearing the voice again was just so touching.
As a seasoned filmmaker, you might have said to yourself,
I have these elements, these are what I need, this is the way I want this story to be told, so that it would be told in an artful way to match the creative nature of the person you're treating.
Mm. How did you make those decisions?
So there are several ways to make a film. One is to structure it, go out and shoot it, collect those elements, bring them home, and cut them together. Obviously, narrative film is done that way. Some improvisation, but in general, narrative film is done that way. Documentaries can be the same way. You can decide exactly what the film will be about, go out and collect that information and bring it home and cut that film together. I felt it wasn't going to be the best or most effective way to tell Wharton's story because he himself was so intuitive in his own thinking, his own ability to listen to nature. And I felt like I needed to listen to his story to allow it to present itself to me. So in part, what I first introduced myself to the curator of the museum and suggested we make a documentary. We went through discussions about that. They ultimately gave me permission. And I, again, thought, I don't really want to make a linear retelling of this man's life. He was born here, he was educated, and so on. And I began to draw on a big piece of white paper all the various dots that we could connect in this story. And so there was the Hedgerow Theater. There were other individuals of note from that area. There was Rose Valley. There was Philadelphia itself. There was his background, his history. And there was a contemporary element to the film. A young man who was the grandson of one of Eschrich's greatest patrons had inherited a grouping of over 150 pieces of Eschrich's work. The funny in his family is they went to get a salad bowl, and 65 pieces later, they got the salad bowl, and Eschrich would come over and say, you need a table here, you need a sideboard there, and continue to make work for them. Jeffrey had inherited a number of pieces. He was interested in moving his life to a different area. He felt it was time to move the pieces on and decided to put them in a gallery and put them up for sale. So there was a contemporary element in my large drawing of different dots to connect. And I, more or less in the same way Wharton Eschrich would say, the wood told me, I allowed the story to tell me and brought that all the way into the editing. So I collected probably 40 to 50 hours of material, different interviews, and filmed the progression of moving the furniture to the gallery sale that night, and various elements like that, and ended up with a 70-minute piece that felt like it was generally working as a story. So even when you go out and collect footage and bring it home and cut it together, there's still the editing that takes a great deal of time and thought and care and consideration, because you want to make sure that while you know the story now inside and out, you can tell a story that other people can view and understand and comprehend and also feel the passion of the, in this case, the artist that went into it. So in creating that 70-minute piece, we began to pull elements out and pull elements out in the same way sculpture takes pieces away and you find the piece inside, right? So there was several months of that editing process, and we ended up with a 41-minute piece now that's the final piece.
And you don't linger on it, but we hear him refer to the importance of music and musicality, mm-hmm. and how does that inform the way the piece unfolds and your use of mm-hmm. music?
Yeah, so growing up with a musical background, my mother and her brothers and sisters performed musically here in the Poconos. Her father played banjo and played banjo with the Tommy Dorsey Band briefly and enjoyed a great deal of music in their background. And while I don't play music, I'm very aware of its power, its emotion. And in every film or story or TV show, music really drives the emotion of the scene. So when we went to approach the music for the film, I thought about nature, I thought about wood, and really wanted to use instruments that created that sort of melodic sensation of the woods and the sound of the woods. So we really looked at specific wood instruments, but I also felt like there was a need for something discordant in the soundtrack. Because again, Wharton wasn't someone who followed the stream, right? He was someone who really went against the stream. And I really wanted to bring minor chords in and make sure that we were hitting some unique sounding melodies behind the piece. So we decided to go with piano and violin and harp. Those are the major instruments throughout. And again, keeping it that simple, we didn't want to go with an orchestration or bring in tons of other instruments to kind of create that again. The simplicity of nature was really important to him. So I reached out to a few different composers and ended up working with two young men who live and work in Manchester, England. We actually worked across the ocean, going back and forth through Skyping and other communication, emails and so on. I played for them several tracks of music that we were using on the rough cut and talked about the nature of the music I was interested in, the types of instruments we wanted to discuss, and they began generating little melodies, you know, just little short melodies. And we landed on the piece that we have now, which has a lovely kind of ongoing hook. And you find that when he's referred to, we return to that. We also used a few pieces of found music. For instance, at the very end, there's this lovely montage that shows the studio throughout all four seasons. One benefit to making the film over 3 years is that you get to see it in four seasons. So we would go and shoot during different seasons. So in the snow, in the beauty of autumn, in the spring with the new leaves coming out, and in the thickness of summer, like you can always see the air. It's so rich and thick and green. And so we used the Clair de Lune track for that, which is a really lovely piece. Schubert is the piano piece we put at the end over the credits, and then we used a piece of opera from Don Juan and a couple other interesting flute pieces from the 1940s. I always think it's important that the film sits, the film is like a boat that sits on the ocean of the music. So for me, the visuals and what is getting said plays against that background. I also like silence. There's an important use of silence throughout. So while the music is something that plays and brings you in and defines the emotion, you also have to leave for the viewer a sense of emptiness, a sense of quiet that allows them to absorb what they've heard and seen in the film.
And that's just the way you began with us when you opened the door about the silence of that space, his workshop itself. You alluded to the screening at the Barnes Foundation. Tell us about how that came to be and what role that will play in the dissemination of the piece.
The Wharton Eshrick Museum, which is in the Paoli area, has been a huge supporter of the film, obviously, and very excited about it. And on their board are several important arts individuals in the Philadelphia area, including people from the Freeman Auction Company, including people from the Modern Gallery, and including people from the David Rago Auction Company. And there was conversation about how to premiere the film, since it's only recently been finished. We just finished in July. And so Freeman approached me to do a screening for more or less a VIP kind of premiere screening and invited me in for the weekend. We screened at the Barnes Foundation in their beautiful theater. And so I couldn't have asked for or hoped for a more lovely opening. We had a panel discussion afterwards and answered a lot of questions. The theater is about 150 seats. We had nearly a full house. And people were very curious about the man himself. Many people knew who Eshrick was, his influence. We were very fortunate to have the Nakashima family come and visit. They're interested in doing a documentary on George Nakashima, fascinating life in his own right. And a number of other supporters and so on were there.
And you alluded to the Etsy phenomenon and that sense of returning to the handmade, the one of a kind. What have you come to understand about the continuing influence of Wharton Eshrick?
I think each of us need to find our own instrument to play, whether you're a musician or an artist or an economist. I don't think the arts hold the only key to expression with creativity. I think all of us are creative. And I think that's part of Wharton Eshrick's legacy. He wanted to pursue something deeply that was truly important to him, that he cared about, that he thought about every day. And in many ways, his personal relationship suffered from that. He was so single-minded and so clear about what he wanted to do. And while we all need to find balance in that, he's known as the Dean of American Craftsmen. And that label essentially is letting us know that he was the forefather of this idea of self-expression. And so as craftspeople today, whether that's individuals who are creating handmade bowls or textiles or ceramics or blowing glass, of course, those are the arts that we think of, but all of us have the ability to express. And I think something important for me about Wharton Eshrick, returning to the idea of the acorn, is that the more we express as individuals, the more we inspire others to express. And I think that's what happens when you go to the Wharton Eshrick Museum. Creativity is everywhere. In the Wharton Eshrick Museum and Wharton Eshrick himself, you're inspired to be more creative in your own life. And again, I don't think that matters if you are pursuing the arts or the sciences. I think we all need to be creative. And part of why we need to be is so that we do inspire others. We give permission to others to do the same.
Take us to a moment in the film that came together for you in a creative way as a filmmaker, and you said, this image or this symbol or this coming together of ideas or these people or what somebody had to say about him and the still photo.
In a project that takes 3 years to produce, this is an independent film. This was a story I thought was important to tell, and I was willing to support it personally through my own resources as well as my time. I knew it would take some time to tell, and it took about 3 years to produce. Over the course of 3 years, making a movie has its ups and downs. There were times when I thought that the film wouldn't get finished. There were times when I thought, this is exactly how it's going to work. Some of the aha moments, in part, were laying out the dots that we needed to connect, finding the quote from Emerson, but also the contemporary sale. The sale was an element that actually helped me structure the piece, because that gave me a linear telling of some part of the story that had a beginning, middle, and end. And also interviewing Bob Baskin. What a treasure, and an interesting individual who shared so many fascinating things, again, not just about Wharton Eshrick, but about himself. His whole idea in interviewing some 30 to 40 people that surrounded Eschwick's life was, as he called it, these various points of light that you could find a way to connect. And I felt like in taking on the project that it was my duty to further his own storytelling through the medium of film. I found more points of light and connected them. So when I knew that he had all this base material, I listened to a good 100 hours of interviews. I transcribed them myself. I went through all the archives, photograph after photograph. And when I began to find photographs of Eschwick and individual pieces of furniture, that's when that assembly in my mind began to happen. So we'll use this piece of furniture with this quote and this idea with his photo, and we're going to open with this piece, and we're going to start with Bob and end with Bob and create a book ending. And in the center of the piece will be the story of this man who's going to sell the work. So things begin to come together. They really do tell you how to tell the story. You have to sit with them, though, and be patient. You have to be a patient documentarian. It can be time-consuming and difficult, but if you're patient, it will come through.
Some of the words you've used, witty, angular, you were choosing some dissonant music and those kinds of adjectives. What about beauty in the sense of his overall aesthetic approach to life and work? Was beauty an important concept to him?
I think more than anyone, Wharton thought of beautiful things as essential. But I don't think he thought about creating beauty. I think what he thought about was listening to the wood, creating pieces that spoke to him for specific individuals and their home. It was rare that he created a piece to create a piece. Unlike painters who think, I'm just going to paint this landscape and it's beautiful and I want to go do that and I'll create a beautiful thing. He really thought very specifically about creating things that were both beautiful, sculptural, and functional. Practicality was also really important to him. You can see that in his studio, you see that in his home, in the workshop that was built with Louis Kahn in the 50s when he started to make more work and needed more space. Practicality was really important to him, combined with beauty. Also, how pieces spoke to one another was very important to him. In creating full rooms or larger roomscapes, he would think, I've created this table, how will the chairs speak to the sides of the table? How will the table and chairs speak to the walls? How will the walls present a place for a cabinet? How will that lead to the next room? How will I put a sofa in this area that will require a shelf? How can I create a music stand that feels like a piece of music for the person that's going to create music on it? How can I give them a little shelf to put their water on? So there was a practicality in addition to the beauty that came through all of his work.
That tells us something then, ultimately, about his understanding of the way in which we surround ourselves with objects or maybe buildings in a strip mall that are horrendous, that it's very important for us as humans to be in the midst mm-hmm. of pieces that are perhaps organic or related in some way to the natural world.
Sure. I think design is everywhere. And there's good design and there's bad design. If you've ever sat on a chair that was uncomfortable, that's bad design. If you've ever tried to open a jar that won't open properly, that's bad design, right? If you can't find your way through a building, that's bad design. And I don't know that enough people consider design. I think furniture is also very important to our home. And in many ways, we take it for granted. But he didn't. He really wanted you to see the design of a room with the design of the pieces and how that told a story. So again, a storyteller in his own right, and how that would work, but also how we live with things. How we live with things. We buy so much from the strip malls and the big stores and so on. But individual pieces, unfortunately, have become out of reach for most people because they become expensive and are harder to make and so on. But there are still so many craftspeople who produce work as an individual piece that means something to you. And I don't know that we feel like meaning is in our furniture anymore. And I think that's something we miss from his era. But you can still find, if you seek out the artists in your community who are making furniture, you can find that.
Tell us how someone listening to our conversation can learn more about your piece.
Sure. So the name of the film is I Am Known as an Artist, Wharton Eschwick. And the reason I titled the film that was at some point in his late 60s, he had received a bill from the utility company. And it was kind of outrageous and they wanted to tax him in a certain way because they thought he had a, quote, business. So he wrote this letter to the utility company that said, really, I'm just this small operation. I have two people that work with me. They're my helpers. And I really am known as an artist. So his salutation was, I am known as an artist, comma, Wharton Eshrick. And so that inspired the film title. So the DVD, I Am Known as an Artist, Wharton Eshrick, is available at the website whartoneshrickdocumentary.com. So you can find it there. Also, if you're in the Philadelphia area or if you're in Pennsylvania, also go to the Wharton Eshrick Museum. And the Wharton Eshrick Museum is online as well. And make a reservation, go see it, walk through with the docents. Wharton Eshrick is, whether or not you see the movie ever, go to the Wharton Eshrick Museum. You won't be disappointed in that. It will inspire something in you.
Filmmaker Carolyn Cole, speaking with us about her recent documentary, I Am Known as an Artist, Wharton Eshrick, that had its premiere at the Barnes Foundation in Philadelphia, September 22, 2017. Carolyn Cole is from the Bloomsburg area. She is now a professor at Cal State University, Fullerton. For more information on the web, whartoneshrickdocumentary.com. whartoneshrickdocumentary.com. Wharton Eshrick is spelled WharTonEshrick. WhartonEshrickDocumentary.com. Carolyn encourages us to investigate the Wharton Eshrick Museum, and we'll find the museum on Horseshoe Trail near Valley Forge National Park in Chester County, Pennsylvania. The museum is a designated National Historic Landmark for architecture. This handcrafted hilltop studio residence, housing more than 200 of Wharton Eshrick's works, has been preserved much as it was when the artist lived and worked there. Guided tours of the studio are available by reservation, Saturdays 10 to 4, Sundays 1 to 4, and Monday through Friday for groups of 5 or more from 10 to 4. For more information about the museum, whartoneshrickmuseum.org. whartoneshrickmuseum.org.